don't we get this party started?
Yeah, we should.
All right. So, listener, the PillPod episodes often are dedicated to what we could call practical philosophy that connects critical theory to everyday events. However, we're in quarantine. That's not our only area of interest. And that's why I invite Chris on here to microdose with us for some more speculative philosophy, like ontology and metaphysics. So that's what we're doing today. Chris, you have heard on the Deleuze episodes and the Vitalism episode, and he's been in retreat to his Heideggerian cabin in the wilderness of Quebec. So how was that for you, my vitalist friend?
It was awesome, actually. I was on a farm with pigs and ducks and acres of land, and it was beautiful.
The pastoral fantasy.
It was literally looking out. By the way, we were in my sister bought a 200-year-old schoolhouse that was like made in 1870 or something and been refurbished, but it has all the old wood and everything in there, so it really did feel like Totenberg.
Well, if you don't know Chris, he is a Schellingian scholar, a scholar of Schelling, and there are not many declarations I make about philosophical beliefs or inclinations, but this is one I believe in, and it's one that we've never actually fought about, surprisingly.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised, since, you know, your own dissertation was deeply influenced by Whitehead and process metaphysics. So
the title of this is Process Metaphysics. And we are going to start with Deleuze and then go backwards to the origin of Western philosophy, because Deleuze is a process metaphysician. And even though we're setting up this binary between practical and pure philosophy, Deleuze didn't really draw that distinction and he didn't really adhere to it. He writes on metaphysics as much as he writes on, capitalism in his works on Bergson, Nietzsche, Spinoza. And we could go on.
Yeah, he would say that he's a transcendental empiricist, but what that itself is a paradox, to say that you're a transcendental empiricist. So, yes, but also Deleuze was quite influenced by one of the biggest process philosophers, right? Henri Bergson, who we all love here on this channel. So,
and Whitehead. And because of Whitehead, I think for myself, I never need to do metaphysics or ontology again, because I think he solved it for me.
That's great. Yes.
I know you're going to hesitate, but this channel is called, or it has it in the subtitle, Critical Theory and Philosophy. So this is your philosophy subsection of that. And when we're doing a microdose, that just means a general introduction to a really broad topic that we happen to find interesting. So this is your broad introduction to process philosophy for which we are going to make a case. Today we're setting the stage. We might do some more in-depth episodes later, depending on the feedback, but that's what we're planning.
I think that, yeah, that's... I hope to do more episodes, but we'll see. We'll see.
So listener, let me set up a binary of philosophers in your mind. There's always problems with binaries, of course, because they create arbitrary distinctions where they don't necessarily exist and they oversimplify. However, they are very useful to compare and contrast, especially if it's a distinction you haven't heard before. So the distinction we're setting up today is between major philosophy and minor philosophy. Otherwise, we could call it process metaphysics versus substance metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to explain that distinction? What would be the paradigmatic example of a substance philosopher, Chris?
I would probably start off with Plato. Plato has an ontology of two different realms, right? The realm of the forms, the realm of the ideas, and the realm of actual entities in the world. So
like time, accidents.
Yes.
And if you take many classes in philosophy, often they will tell you that Plato is the origin of Western philosophy, which is totally wrong. And we're going to make that case today.
Although Whitehead says Whitehead does love Plato.
Oh, it's not about loving and non-loving. It's about, do we want to set Okay, why don't we just get to this distinction? If we're talking about substance philosophy, for you, the world is made up of things. So things are the originary, most basic level of reality, whether they are forms in Plato or, for Aristotle, special substances called ousia or something like that. By the way, I don't know any Greek pronunciation, so this will be a theme if I'm mispronouncing them. I don't know if anyone knows the pronunciation of ancient Greek, but just in case they do. Ousia is the special substances. So for them, the basis of reality is in things, and things that have identities and shapes and numbers, and they're countable. Whereas process metaphysics says things only exist after they start to interact in time. So it's their relation to each other temporally that causes things to begin existing. So when we're talking about substance versus process metaphysics, the question we're really asking is what comes first, interactions or objects? Even if those objects are invisible, even if they are mental objects like concepts or forms or ideas.
That's a really good place to start. Because process metaphysics, if I want to give a definition here, right, is an ontology-based philosophy that has two kinds of existence. Actual entities are kind of spatio-temporally are understood as extended events or processes. And there's an ontology of like two kinds of existences here, of entities. Events that are, you know, things and abstract entities or ideas, like what you were just saying a second ago.
So yeah, if you can think of the most permanent object you can think of, like a tree, or actually even more than a tree, because philosophers always use trees as an example. If you can think of a mountain seems like the most solid object you've ever observed or witnessed phenomenally. But a mountain is actually just a very slow process of two, you know, earth plates meeting each other and pushing each other up, and then a mountain is formed. So the idea behind process metaphysics is that even at the level of causation and even at the level of ideas, interaction and process comes first, and time comes first, not space and not objects.
Mm-hmm. That's a good distinction.
Deleuze is beholden to this because Deleuze, as you said, gets his metaphysics as a mix of Spinoza and Bergson and Whitehead, all of whom we would classify probably as process philosophers.
Right. So for Deleuze, the first thing is that being is dynamic, and that the dynamic nature of being should be the primary focus of any kind of comprehensive philosophy. So he wants to look at these... He would call them, you know, in the relation between the virtual and the actual, which we've talked about before. He wants to talk about all these processes as relations. He wants to talk about the kind of relational ontology. And like my favorite example that Deleuze gives is a thunderstorm. A thunderstorm isn't just one event. A thunderstorm is cool air, warm air, condensation, tension, all swirling together to form this event that we call a thunderstorm.
Yeah, so we have one name for the thing. And having one name for it kind of throws you off and thinking, oh, this must be one thing. But if you look at any thing, according to process philosophy and Deleuze, then it's going to be a million different interactions.
Right.
And the interactions are primary. This thunderstorm is not primary. It's a pattern recognized only after all of the interactions happen. And he would say the same thing about you, by the way, as a person. It's yes. Not that you have like a soul that wanders throughout the world and has all these accidental events happen to it. First of all, you're a bunch of processes, and then you emerge into something like consciousness or a sense of self, which is very different from philosophy like Descartes, for example, which is the most...
Right.
Everyone likes to bag on Descartes for exactly this reason, and we're not going to do that too much today.
No, this idea of the body is a perfect example, because think of the body as multiple events, multiple organisms interacting, and the relations, the eye for sight, the ear, the mouth, the the heart processes, the breathing, everything, your olfactory senses. I mean, there's so many things going on within the body. The bacteria that's in the intestines, the lining of the stomach. I mean, there are several interrelations that make up the human animal.
And they come to form a sense of self, and he's not denying that, but that sense of self is emergent. It's not primary, it's an emergent property. So your consciousness is not self-identical to your identity, it's emergent from your body.
Right.
But Plato, obviously, was not the kind of thinker who would think in these terms. So we're not even saying that Plato's, you know, nuts, because for Plato, it kind of makes sense to open up your eyes and look around the world and see, oh, everything's changing. Things disappear into nothing, and then they come back seemingly from nothing. So it's not insane to think, oh, if we just look behind all of the appearances, what are called accidents in philosophy, if you look behind all the accidents, there must be something maintaining all of these emergent accidents.
Right.
And process metaphysics is saying, no, you don't need something behind it all. The something that you feel might be behind it all actually comes from just witnessing all of these emergences. So, as we said, Deleuze gets his metaphysics from a bunch of sources, but we're instead of going to start with Whitehead and Bergson, why don't we start at the beginning, at the very first process philosopher, at least according to, I think it was Heidegger.
I think we can easily say, but you know, just before we step
into the river,
yes. There's a good distinction here that we're making between, you know, substance and relations, like Parmenides, who has a kind of monism. And then there is Heraclitus, who I would say is the first process metaphysician. For Heraclitus, things are constantly changing and are always in a flux. There's a spontaneity of becoming always there. In process, relations are interrelated, they're overlapping.
And we're making the corny joke, of course, that Heraclitus, I mean, his most famous quote is, you can never step in the same river twice. So the question behind that is, of course, what do you call a river? Is a river a substance or is it a process? Famously quoted, by the way, in Disney's Pocahontas, which has no philosophical problems.
I was thinking of Cryptis thy phalai, the nature loves to hide, the fact that we can never capture nature, since nature is always in process. Nature is concealing itself and revealing itself, and it's always in this constant flux of moving from one condition to the other, or one process to the other. But yes, Disney.
So we're going to the very roots of the tree here when we're talking about metaphysics. Maybe we should define metaphysics, actually. So phusis in Greek means nature. So Aristotle wrote a book called The Physics, which is just about nature. And it means more or less what we consider physics to be today. How do objects and bodies interact in space? And metaphysics, there's actually a long story going back to this. I think it's like some early Christian monk or something just had to name this book, Aristotle's book, what's now called the Metaphysics. He had to name it something, and it was sitting next to the Physics, so he just called it the Metaphysics. So the way we use the word meta today is erroneously derived from this etymology, where we think meta means something over top, right? Like Chris,
or beyond the physical.
Yeah, when we're playing D&D, you're not allowed to metagame, because that means going outside of the game or going over top of the game. But meta,
and I'm guilty of doing that all the time.
but meta in the Greek etymology just means like next to or around. So the reason he named metaphysics is just because it was the book that was sitting around the book on the Physics.
Yes.
So it's a mistaken etymology that now means, yeah, when we're talking about like I don't know, what's another example of the way we misuse the word meta? Meta-narrative, right? It's a narrative that overarches all of history, and that's an erroneous attribution to whoever named Aristotle's book, The Metaphysics. Anyway, metaphysics is the study of causality, which is close to ontology, which is the study of what is. So we are at the very root of the tree of knowledge when we're talking about Heraclitus versus something like Plato and Aristotle. So in major philosophy versus minor philosophy, Plato and Aristotle won out. Because if you're taking a course on intro to Western philosophy, you always start with Plato. And if you read Deleuze's canon, it's not one that starts with Plato. In fact, Heidegger said something like, philosophy was ruined by Plato, or philosophy ended the minute that Plato started writing. So we had everything that was good had been done before. But Heraclitus has this primordial element, like all the pre-Socratic philosophers were trying to find the primordial element. Was it air? Was it water? And Heraclitus thought it was fire. And that's interesting because fire is always in process. Fire is not a thing. It's a reaction or an interaction between other things.
Does fire really burn the wood when you put the wood in the fireplace? Like, what's going on between the relations between the two of them there?
Yeah, and the wood can be said to be an object, but the fire can't really be said to be an object. It's sort of an emergence or a process.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I like this start with Heraclitus and emergentism. Would you say that emergentism is a movement claim where the mind emerges from matter, plastic?
Well, for something to be emergent, it's only to say that it's to admit that the thing exists. So yeah, you can say that the mind exists, and there's no problem saying that the mind exists. It's just saying that it emerges from a multivalent layer of processes underneath it, which include, like we already said, your body, your brain, the whole evolution of the human race from like lower organisms. So your mind is emergent from that whole process. It doesn't exist on its own, which is very different from something like what Descartes or even Kant said, that your mind is basically something that has fixed vectors by which it can interact with the world.
Yeah, I was just about to say as a side note here, that when it comes to process metaphysics, we're making a distinction that's not in the school of rationalism or empiricism. So we kind of have a kind of realism going on here, or a philosophy of things that emerge outside of, in the Kantian terms, the categories or faculties, not to get all jargony with philosophy here.
Well, to get jargony for 1 second, why don't you explain, Chris, the Deleuzian concept of univocity? Because that's really important here.
Okay.
So univocity, I'll just give you the etymology breakdown. Univocity means one voice or one utterance. And what does that mean for Deleuze?
So Deleuze gets this concept of the univocity of being from Don Scotus, the famous scholastic philosopher. But really, univocity is talking about how everything is related imminently in one kind of nice little process. At the end of Difference and Repetition, he talks about 1 million or 1,000 vibrations. This is a good example, an echo or a vibration. An echo is just a simple sound. However, as the sound picks up and picks up its momentum, it becomes more than just a sound. It's now moving, or even ripples in a water, right? They make more ripples and more ripples.
Okay, you're out in space. I can do this more simply. And if you want to follow all of those terms, they're all correct. They're in Deleuze. And he's prone to not using terms that are familiar to us. But univocity just means that everything is made out of the same stuff. There's not multiple layers to reality. Whereas if you think of someone like Plato's the one that we're just dunking on all day here. But Plato says, no, there's what appears to be reality, appearances, and then there's real reality. And real reality is behind appearances. Whereas what we see is just fake reality. So as soon as you make that move philosophically, you're saying that there's multiple levels of reality, which is a dualvosity. But a univocity says, no, everything is the same stuff. There's no such thing as representation, because even to make a representation, you have to use the same stuff that the thing you're trying to represent is made out of. So your example of ripples in water, which is immanent to itself, there's not anything besides the water. There's not water and air. There's just the water and the movement, the vibrations that occur in the water is all there is, which is to say that everything is immanent to itself, which is a univocal relationship of reality.
You said that much more elegantly than me. You can tell that I'm very rusty at the podcast thing.
No. You know all the terms. It's about making the terms simplified. So we are simplifying, and that's the whole purpose of this microdose. All right, so if you want to categorize a whole bunch of philosophers, people who would have this dualvosity or a multi-layered reality, we would say start with Plato. We have Aristotle, most of the Christian medieval philosophers, including Thomas Aquinas, and up until Kant, for sure. And then after Kant, we have logical positivists and so on, who believe that, like, if you believe in math and logic, more or less, you believe that there's some representation to what we call the objects of math and logic, which are things or substances. And the minor tradition here starts with Heraclitus. We have Leibniz, who said that the present is always pregnant with the future, which is sort of a temporal emergence. Bergson, as we mentioned, C.S. Peirce, Hegel, maybe?
White.
Would you say Hegel is a process metaphysician?
Well, okay, so Hegel's a special case because of one important thinker that has imparted great influence on Whitehead, and that's F.H. Bradley, who is was the British Hegelian. And Bradley's text, Appearance and Reality, it's the text that Whitehead picks up. And what he's concerned about is this exact problem of substance versus relations, relational philosophies. And so it's here where Bradley is more focused on the appearances and how appearances and their relational events happen within how we see them, how they are unfolded. Whitehead takes this a little bit and moves further. So let's just say the Hegelianism of Bradley could be seen as process philosophy. I'm not sure about Hegel.
Because Hegel says the truth emerges through history, but also that there's this absolute to which all of history is relative to. So the history part seems like something processual, and then the absolute part seems like something substantial. And I don't actually know enough about Hegel to comment on whether that absolute is emergent or not.
But you know who I would say?
All right.
You know who I would say?
Yeah.
And I'm just going to do it because he's my boy. I got to do this. I would, because of someone like Matthew T. Siegel, I've started to see like Schelling as a process philosopher. So like Schelling's philosophy of nature, he starts off with this idea of the unconditioned, which is kind of like a univocity, where there is an ultimate productivity that is always producing. And when it stops or when it interacts with what he calls actants, relations are formed, and out of those relations become products. So we have the producing, the productivity, and then we have products. So you can see something like this as a kind of process metaphysics.
And probably Nietzsche is a process metaphysician in saying there is no being, there's only becoming. There's no guiding principle in history. There's no universal subject. The universal subject emerges from the genealogy, right? A genealogy of knowledge.
Well, now we're getting a little controversial here because I'm not sure if Nietzsche is a volunteerist in regards to like the philosophy of will, but in the Deleuzian reading of Nietzsche, yes, Nietzsche for sure is definitely up there with process metaphysics, especially with the eternal return.
And just because we might be losing people here, why don't we frame this? How would this change your thinking about events in the world if you were a process philosopher versus a substance philosopher? Because we already gave the example. I mean, I think the best example is probably, are you a thing? Are you a thinking thing? Or are you an emergent identity that comes from your body? So that's the most important way to consider this. But if you're thinking about other events, even world events, how would substance versus process division change your mind in thinking about that, Chris?
Well, the first thing is that substance philosophies tend to see the world filled with furniture, filled with objects. They're just objects out there. They don't see the kind of living, this is where my kind of vitalist tension comes in here. They don't see the interconnection, the relations between specific things. They simply see things in compartments. They categorize things as simple objects that are separated from other objects that are either there to be used or to be interacted with.
Right. So if you want to have like a galaxy brain where everything is one, everything's connected, there's no division between your ego and the universe, you want to be a process philosopher.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's as funny as this sounds and almost like it's occulty, I guess, in a weird way. There is this kind of everything is interconnected. And I don't want to say this. I don't want to sound like I'm getting all weird on everybody or you know, let's go hug a tree or something. But the whole idea is that each thing in the world is an actant. Each thing in the world is an actor that is connected within everything else. There are processes and changes and becomings happening all the time, and they cannot be isolated as this tree is this substance. No, this tree is a part of a greater forest or a part of this, or everything is a part of, as you said, you know, a ripple within the pond of several other ripples that are interacting, overlapping, and conditionally moving forward. There's a continuity of movement. This is the whole idea. And even in Bergson, this is this idea of movement that is the key aspect of life, the progression of life.
And no matter how small the act is, the thought behind univocity is that it affects every other thing in the universe, even if there's no measurable effect, right? If there's an event that happens, it affects everything else. And Whitehead was not being occulty when he framed his process metaphysics like this. He was looking at the results of quantum field theory in the 30s. And well, was he actually? I think I always assumed that he was, but I never actually looked up his biographical details to make sure that
he was the only philosopher at the time that was deeply interested by Einstein's physics.
Well, Einstein wasn't on board with quantum field theory at the beginning. I don't know if he ever was, actually.
No. Okay. I just meant that he had a level of grasp on physics.
Presumably Whitehead was looking at, he already had these things bouncing around in his brain before this, but presumably he was looking at some of the results from quantum field theory and the interaction. By the way, I'm not a physicist. I know enough of the vocabulary of quantum physics to be able to relate what Whitehead said about it, but by no means am I an expert. But the interaction between particles that are both dually waves and particles. It's not like being a particle is primary and being a wave function is secondary. The collapse happens when those two things interact, which is why like a double slit experiment determines the outcome by what you're causing to interact in that experiment. So
and this is why it's so hard for us to understand when we move from substance philosophy into process philosophy, something like the superposition that you're talking about, entanglement.
Well, I'm not talking about entanglement here.
Oh, Christ.
It's only to say that the process of measuring a particle generates that particle as a particle rather than as being a wave function. So what Whitehead calls feelings, for him, the world is made out of occasions. So occasions, of course, is a temporal word. It's a word about time. Occasions is a meeting. And a meeting happens when things feel each other. And Whitehead never, ever put this into terms of atoms and subatomic particles. But for him, the emergence of consciousness, which he wrote a lot about in terms of the superject, comes from these interactions. It doesn't come from things bouncing into each other. And that's the main difference, again, between substance metaphysics and process metaphysics, is it's the bounce between two, you know, billiard balls, to use a Galilean example. It's the bounce between the objects that creates reality. It's not the objects on their own. So this is where this comes into saying this is just about what happens in time.
Right. And there's more going on between the bounce between those two billiard balls, right? There is the inertia. There's the, as they hit each other, they're moving in directions. They're now affected by their, by the causal act between the two of them.
Right. So it's much more than objects interacting. It's all of these emergent properties that all come to play in the interaction. And that interaction is what's crucial here. And this is why we have a univocal world instead of a world of representation. Why don't we jump back to Bergson? Because Bergson has a theory of time, and I think he actually rejected, since we're speaking about the interaction of science and philosophy, didn't Bergson like reject Einstein or something like that?
So to this day, Einstein's Nobel Prize is, I think, for something to do with Planck. It has nothing to do with his...
It's about subatomic particles, not about relativity, right?
Right, exactly, yes. And this is because Bergson was debating him on time. And he said that time cannot be relative. Time is metaphysical for him. And this is why I wanted to bring up this idea of realism, idealism, and the problem between the two of them. Because for Bergson, there is something metaphysical that's going on within the movement of time and memory at the same as well. That memory and time are like a layer of reality that is a constant homogeneous process.
So we're not separating, like if you were a rationalist, you would separate your memory from reality and say like that memory is not real. That memory is like a phantasm or something like that. But for Bergson, your memory is extremely part and partial to your movement of your body throughout the world. So I think I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a good example of how this univocal relationship is expressed. It's not like your memory is false. Your memory is created out of an interaction.
Right. Actually, he gave it, Bergson has this great example in Matter and Memory of Alzheimer's patients. Now, Alzheimer's patients, they forget who they are in their memories. Like they forget who they are. But they still have the relational experience, right? They still have this layer. They can still write their names. They can still write specific things.
And there's this great story about I'm gonna butcher it probably, but it's this story about a patient who had like it was like Memento. He's got like a 5-minute memory or whatever, and then he was talking about his father. Or something, and he had already had this condition once his father had died, but he, in speaking, said or referred to his father in the past tense, like he was a good man or something like that. So even though he had this memory condition where he couldn't form memories, somewhere in his body, which is like your memories inextricably entangled with your body, he knew that his father had died, even though he couldn't form new memories.
That's a great example. And so this is what Bergson was alluding to, that time as process is a primordial entity. I don't want to say entity. It's a primordial conception of being. It's not just one train is moving faster than the other train and you can see the light or you can't see the light or something. That was a terrible example.
No, that's the Einstein relativity theory based on the position of the observer. Yeah, I get what you're saying. Look it up. Anyway, so we're talking about time as like always evolving around us, as opposed to the Western philosophical notion that your mind is distinct from time or separate from time, or that it represents time to you. In this model, in process metaphysics, time is much more inextricably linked to your engagement with every part of the world. And even the way that, like, we could expand this even further to something like systems theory, where societies evolve in time, not because of, you know, atomistic human individuals, but because of the actions that take place between those human individuals. So this is very much a way of saying that everything is interconnected and every event has repercussions that are almost inobservable. And I think the reason that I'm partial to this view, and maybe you can answer this for yourself, but the reason I'm partial to this view is because it shows that the distinction between representation and reality, that's the thing that's in our heads. That's the thing that we made up because we're so used to identifying patterns. And once we're identifying patterns, then it looks for sure like the world is made out of entities and substances and things. But I think it seems to be much more true to form that the world is made out of emergent processes. And that's why we're voting for this process philosophy, or what Whitehead calls organic philosophy.
No, I like this idea of organic philosophy. I like this idea of, because it, you can take it through so many different levels. You can take it to one of our other podcasts that we talked about with vitalism. You could talk about it in regards to deep ecology, several things. We're no longer compartmentalizing specific entities. We're no longer talking about this and individuating it. Its individuation is that it's in process, but also different from other entities, but still always in relation to them.
So rather than Plato being confused about how, you know, things can emerge, things can die, then other things are born. So he says there must be some like backdrop behind this. There must be forms that are behind all this. Then instead you say, no, everything is different from every other thing. So there aren't real categories. The categories is what you bring phenomenally to the world. But on its own, the world is pure process, pure becoming.
This is really good example in Deleuze's book on Leibniz, on the fold. And his idea is, you think of a sheet of paper. The sheet of paper can be folded into any shape. It has the possibility to be folded, unfolded in endless possible space, endless possible shapes. However, as you bend and fold the paper, there are other relations are formed. Other aspects of the sheet of paper is now touching other aspects. This is also an aspect of process philosophy.
Yeah, we might like the butterfly effect as an example. And as one more way for our listeners to kind of form a mental picture of this, we're very used to thinking of ideas as art or photographs, right? As visual phenomena, as representations in visual form. So like a memory is a mental picture. And throughout Western philosophy, like Plato even started talking about you know, paintings of tables are not tables, and tables are representations of invisible tables that have never existed, perfect tables or whatever. But the other example, and this is where I think Deleuze bounces off Nietzsche a lot, is instead of talking about visual phenomena, which seem to be substances, right? They have outlines, they're coherent, there's a boundary between them and the world. But instead of thinking about that, think about music and think about how rhythm affects your body and how music is a process. Music, well, I mean, now we can record it, of course, but before we could record music, it's a completely temporal event. So if we have our model of reality as something that is based on something like music and waves of sound through space, rather than individuated, identified, boundaried images, then I think we might have a richer picture of the interconnectivity of the world. And this sounds like something, I don't know, it's, I would call it Bergsonian, you know, Buddhism or something like that. This just, oh, bro, everything's interconnected, everything's touching each other. But that's really what's at stake in this philosophy versus a philosophy of vision or a philosophy of identity.
But think about this for a second. This is a really good example. Everyone has that one song that always stays in their head. So think about the time you're driving in your car, you hear this song. It's on the radio. You're like, ugh, I'm stuck in traffic. You're hearing this song. But when you go home, that song is just as vivid and it's playing in your head and you're still affected. It still affects your mood. You could sing it. You could get goosebumps from it. You could get tingles. I don't know.
Or yo, it just emerges randomly when you're doing something else, right? You wake up in the middle of the night and the song's in your head. And this is in the Thousand Plateaus chapter on the refrain.
Yeah.
So we should have maybe started with this, because this is a great example. A song is not an object. A song is not a thing. A song is a pattern that repeats. So if you think of reality as a song instead of a picture, and just because I said that, we can bounce back rhizomatically to Heidegger's essay, The Age of the World Picture, because Heidegger's more on the side of process philosophy than substance philosophy. He says, the age of the world picture is the age when we see the world as a picture only. But if you see it as a song, like you said, it has this emergence, this accidentalness, this repetition through time. And it's the pattern that creates the object, not the object that creates the pattern.
Exactly. And a song, a simple song, can trigger any kind of memory. A breakup with a girlfriend or a boyfriend. School, your friends or something.
Those summer nights, hanging in the woods, drinking beer on the hood of your Camaro.
Yes.
So Whitehead has this quote that I like. Very simple. Nature is a process. And he starts off from the very basic interactions of things, which he actually gathers up from Spinoza and calls them something like monads or data. And from these individual interactions, then we get something as incredibly complex as human consciousness. And Descartes made the error, cogito ergo sum, which supposes that the I exists before the thinking exists. I think, therefore I am, which means the I comes first. And that's wrong. It should just be, you know, because of thought I am, instead of because I think, therefore I am.
There's, yeah, absolutely. Because when you're this idea of the self, or even the cogito, what is the cogito but an endless, infinite amount of relations, right? Like for Descartes to say, I think, therefore I am, he has to understand the relation between the chair he's sitting in, the pipe he's smoking, the fire that he's looking at, and the paper that he's writing with. All are interconnected within one event that is leading up to his meditation. So he doesn't even realize, because he's too busy compartmentalizing every experience, dividing everything, wiping it away. So he can talk about two substances, mind and body, and actually the meditation's called Why the Mind is Known Better Than the Body. But what he's really done is he's gotten rid of all relations. The relations between the paper, the pen, the fireplace, the clothes he's wearing. You know, all of these things that have set up this event that is him writing this meditation.
Anyways. Yeah, and the only reason he can start doing that meditation is because he already had lunch. Because if he was hungry and feeling the pangs of hunger in his stomach, then his body would be telling him to get his ass out of his chair and go eat something instead of reflecting on how the body and the mind are connected by the pineal gland or some arbitrary distinction that he made.
Or the abstraction of thought. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The event of thinking itself. The fact that he can remember specific ideas that he has put together, collected together, and now put them in a kind of metaphysical argument.
So why don't we end by going like way out to lunch here and talk about Whitehead's panentheism, which is different from pantheism in that pantheism means God is everything, whereas panentheism means that God is in everything as the thing that exists in all interactions. Because obviously for Whitehead, everything is an interaction. Everything is a feeling, which is actually a philosophical term that he reappropriates from normal English. But all things are feelings. And he says, quote, "The actual world is a process, and that process is the becoming of actual entities." So you don't start with things, but things occasion into each other. They feel each other, just the way like you hear a song, and that song contributes to your thought. It's not that your thought exists independently of the world.
He calls this prehension, right?
That's the state of anticipating events.
But you know, I kind of subscribe to this kind of panentheism because it also leads to Whitehead's panpsychism, which is that all emergent forms of matter have mind, but not mind in the sense of consciousness, the sense that they are related to one another and each even dead matter itself is somehow affecting or epiphenomenally affecting some form of entity.
Yeah, I don't like going to this realm too much, but I mean, what's actually happening though is like when you reflect on the entire history of the universe, just sitting in your chair, that is an example of the universe folding back on itself, because the universe is thinking itself through your mind. And like I said, I don't like going there myself. It just seems spacey. But a lot of people like it. I've heard it said, and I think you might be one of those people.
I think I'm spacy.
So why don't you describe for me that experience of, I don't know, ego death and the world thinking itself through you? Describe it in phenomenological terms.
It's not so. I see this as a Schellingian. Schelling has this great line where he says that spirit is invisible nature. Nature is visible spirit. They are connected. Subject and object are interconnected. And this interconnection between the real and the ideal, the subject and the object, they are combined as in, you know, their identity is like two, like your left hand and your right hand. They're both hands, but each of them kind of reflect the one and the other. This is how I see it. I see it in this sense. I don't think the rock and the ground and everything else is has a mind and is, you know, but I do think in terms of Deleuze that what we call consciousness to any other form of matter is still a form of expressivity. It's still expressing itself. The tree is expressing itself by leaning this way, by getting light, turning it into simple sugars within photosynthesis. The grass sheltering other insects, etc. The earth having multiple living organisms intertwined, geological rocks, etc., etc., etc. All of these things all enmeshed, right? And you can see it in a funny way. There's this great example from Ravaisson about a color red, the redness of your wall is not just one color. There are little tiny degrees of redness that build up this one redness of a wall. So there's multiple layers, multiple dimensions that are all interconnected, interrelated.
Without getting galaxy brained, what this does, it represses that instinct to make things into abstractions. Because if everything is univocal, everything is part of this univocity, one substance reality, then there's no such thing as representation that's distinct from that. There's no such thing as abstraction that's not already part of nature, because that abstraction is coming from your mind, which is coming from, you know, your evolution and your stomach, gut, and the bacteria that live inside you are all affecting the way that you're thinking about stuff. So it's only an illusion that we can separate mind from nature in that respect, because our mind is expressing the, what would you call it? I don't want to get too galaxy brained here, but the fact that you can consider the events on a star a million miles away is reflective of nature folding onto itself, as you brought up that example previously from Deleuze.
But even this idea of nature, we tend to see ourselves as Homo sapiens, and then there's nature. And right there, I categorized us, an animal, a living animal, and I differentiated us from nature. No, that's not true. That's incorrect. We are within nature. We reflect nature as nature reflects us. Just like I brought up this example of the two hands. It's not that we're separated. It's that we're within and we reflect nature as nature reflects us. We're a part of this. We are a part of the process of nature. So it's not just we divide these two entities. There are multiple entities that make up nature. We're one of those entities.
Yeah, and there's another example I could point to is when we talk about the laws of nature, it's like nature exists following these laws. But in this sense, those laws would be part of a substance metaphysics, as if they pre-exist somehow. But from the perspective of process metaphysics, those laws emerge from all of the interactions that nature has with each other, whether they're, I don't know, electrons or whatever. But those laws emerge. They don't predate.
You know, this is a really funny memory of you and I. I'm just going to bring up a memory that gives a really good example, because it's not just about organicism. It's everything. Pills and I were on top of a massive building in Toronto drinking some beers, and I looked out, me being the so-called vitalist idealist, looked outside at all these buildings and roads and cars and everyone moving around, and I said, "Oh, look at this machination." And he said, "What do you mean machination? This is process." And I said to him, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, look, each of the roads lead to somewhere. There are cars going specific areas. Buildings are interconnected. There is life emergent right here. There's cars moving here and there that are still taking up a specific space, that are still here within time."
Sounds like I had a bit too much.
You got
to
me
drink
there, Pills.
All right. Well, why don't we leave it on that note? Good anecdote of a time when I was unwittingly wise. Thanks for coming back, Chris, and I hope you guys had some interest or got your brain percolating in some area about this stuff. We don't actually get a lot of feedback on this, so I don't know where it lands all the time, but if you like this or you want us to just talk about one thinker for an hour, we can definitely do that on an overdose episode.
Yes. If you want to hear me stutter some more on another podcast.
For now, thank you, Chris. Thank you for coming back from the wildernesses of Quebec. I can imagine that must have been a traumatic experience to return to your quarantine block in the suburbs.
So, to talk about relations, just coming back to Toronto and smelling air, the air was absolutely heavy. The air where I was so clean, and I mean, I sound, as you said, spacey, But there really is a difference there. There really is an absolute difference.
Has it affected your mood too? Your affective carrying of yourself?
Well, let me tell you, yeah, in a weird way, yes, it did actually. But you, from there, you see, you know, a small town, whatever, farmland, farmers, everything, the whole little town itself is interconnected, and everyone knows who and blah 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 blah. Anyways, this is nothing to do with what we're talking about.
No, if it has an effect on your interaction with the world, like your disposition, your prehensions, as Whitehead would say, towards the world, then that would be, you know, evidence of this interconnectivity that is forgotten by Cartesian dualism.
I just think that a lot of people, because they keep up their daily mundane routine, that their, you know, their absorbedness, as Heidegger says, their throwenness, the constitution of Dasein's, you know, kind of absorbedness into the world, they miss certain things. And my favorite poet, who's a kind of, you know, very big, his name is Angelus Silesius, talks about the rose without no why, the rose without why. And it's, the rose is just there. The rose doesn't need a why. Like, we don't need a why either. Everything is there, and we kind of take it for granted. Anyways, I'm going off here. Spacey, again.
Well, I'm sure that some people would like to be spacey, and, you know, being spacey without some metaphysical backing makes you kind of a kook, right? But if you're going to think through it carefully, as you have, I'm just saying I'm not going to put my effort into that. But if you have, and you have,
but you knew,
then that's an admirable trait and example to follow.
I think it's weird that we didn't bring up the three-letter word today. We didn't bring up God at all today. I think that's kind of weird that we didn't bring. We're talking about process metaphysics, and it didn't come up.
Panentheism.
True. Yes.
The theos, yes, in panentheism is God. Anyway, we'll save that for another time. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Goodbye, Chris. Thanks for coming by.
All right, Pills. Thanks a lot.